As a philosopher of science, as Miriam has indicated, my abiding interest has been archaeology, a conjunction of fields that invariably provokes puzzled questions. Archaeology is such an earthbound, data-driven enterprise, and philosophy is so abstract and wholly intellectual. What's the connection, I get asked. Bringing an eretetic lens to bear, I've been intrigued by the number of different targets and contrast classes that animate these questions. Once when I was a visiting student at Oxford in the late 70s, an elderly Oxford don, having inquired politely about my interests at a high table dinner, tartly observed that archaeology isn't a science, so I could not possibly be writing a dissertation in philosophy of science on archaeology. He not so politely turned and talked to the other people at the table for the rest of the dinner. At job interviews a few years later in the early 80s, think ballroom, you know, interview table settings, a standard opening gambit was to ask, so what's philosophical about the work you do on archaeology? Those were the more, that was at the dire end of the spectrum. More querulously, what could possibly be of philosophical interest in archaeology? And from archaeologists weary of the theory wars that raged through the 1980s and 90s, I'll come back to them in a moment, sometimes the response would be, what's the point? Better to just step away from wrangling about philosophical isms and get on with the empirical work that needs doing. More sympathetic questioners typically ask how possibly questions. How did I come to work at this odd intersection of fields? The invitation to give a Dewey lecture gives me license to address this last genre of puzzlement, but it's also an opportunity, as the mandate for the Dewey lectures suggests, to reflect on a major sea change that's taken place in philosophy of science in the 40 years or so I began thinking about how philosophy bears on archaeology and archaeology on philosophy. I see this as an eminently Deweyan shift toward grounding philosophical analysis in robust, richly contextualized understanding of scientific inquiry, specifically the messy contingent details of empirical research practice. Of course, we philosophers of science have been intent on naturalizing our field since at least the early 70s. We've worked through several iterations of affiliation with history of science, and some of us now see sociological science studies as a crucial resource rather than a threat to all things epistemic. What's distinctive and distinctively Deweyan at this juncture is a commitment to take up questions that matter in practice to scientists and also to policymakers, funders, and indeed all those affected by the practice and results of scientific inquiry. I would argue, in response to the querulous, that these questions are every bit as philosophical and at least as intellectually challenging as those that are often taken to be canonical in more rarefied philosophical traditions of thinking about scientific knowledge. In my case, this has mainly been a matter of articulating an account of evidence or evidential reasoning in non-foundational terms, an undertaking that has been both provoked and informed by the challenges of archaeological practice. In short, what I aim to bring into focus is a reorientation that I think of as philosophy engaged, evident to differing degrees in all our varied fields of philosophical inquiry. Here's the autobiographical bit. I note that the mandate for Dewey says that these should typically be senior people, usually retired. Not retired. And they do allow that autobiographical lens should be brought to bear. So here's the autobiographical bit. I came by my interest in archaeology honestly. Doing field work was a family affair. My parents were keen avocational archaeologists who, over several summers in the mid-60s, arranged to join a family friend on a series of projects sponsored by the Canadian National Museum. They were surveying and excavating, or testing, contact period Huron and Iroquois sites along the St. Lawrence River. The family friend, Jim Pendergast, you see him in his more sort of sartorial mode on the top left, was later honored in 1991 by the Society for American Archaeology with the Crabtree Award, and that's the award notification. It's for lifetime achievement as an avocational archaeologist. He was described in the dedication of Efesdrift as the archaeologist who had done more than anyone else, I quote, to build an understanding of the enigmatic Iroquoian-speaking communities who Jacques Cartier encountered at Hochelaga and Stadacona in 1535-1536. Hochelaga and Stadacona are now, are on the sites where Montreal and Quebec City later developed. These communities were a force to reckon with. They decisively repelled the French after some seriously bad behavior by Jacques Cartier and his company, after a contentious winter. But when Samuel, and essentially convinced the French that it wasn't worth their while to try to settle that region, make it part of a French domain at the time. But when Samuel de Champlain returned some 70 years later, they had disappeared. These communities were nowhere to be found. Debate about what happened continues to the present day. Certainly, these Iroquoian speaking groups would have been hard hit by European diseases and no doubt targeted in the trade war, the fur trade wars, given their strategic position on the St. Lawrence. But what was the significance from an archaeological point of view of finding distinctive St. Lawrence Iroquoian material culture on Huron sites of that period? On one hand, some assumed that the remnants of the destroyed Iroquoian-speaking, or the St. Lawrence Iroquois had had taken refuge with their Huron neighbors. Others thought that the survivors of other conflicts might have been taken captive by the Huron. The debate continues. Pendergast went on to serve as an assistant director of the National Museum and worked closely with a towering figure in academic archaeology in Canada and internationally, Bruce Trigger. They together reframed the so-called mystery of the St. Lawrence Iroquois in terms that opened space for recognizing a much more dynamic pre-contact and contact period history with much greater political complexity and self-determination than suggested by the records of the European intruders. Here's Bruce Trigger, and he was a self-avowed Marxist and a thoughtful historian, very philosophical historian of archaeology. Also one of the first outspoken critics of racialized stereotypes that had informed the history and archaeology of contact period interactions between indigenous people and Europeans in Eastern North America. As a graduate student, I wrote a review of a remarkable book that Trigger published in 78, Time and Traditions, Essays in Archaeological Interpretation. And I was later deeply influenced by his 1980 essay, Archaeology and the Image of the American Indian. It stands as a sort of turning point in discussion about the presuppositions that informed archaeological interpretation. I didn't discover philosophy until I took my first college-level classes at Mount Allison University in New Brunswick in the early 70s. I was hooked by the time I finished the first semester of a year-long introduction to philosophy that, as luck would have it, was taught by one of the early pioneers of philosophy of chemistry, Paul Bogard. Here's Paul lecturing, as he likes to do. And also, a little list at the bottom, due to von Brockel, that indicates where his contributions came in the formation of philosophy of chemistry. In that context, although I'd never been formally taught philosophy, I'd been drawn to philosophical questions, especially epistemic questions, in just about every subject I'd studied, helped along by a particularly philosophical math teacher in middle school and some highly intellectual Jesuits in high school. But the first time I made the connection between philosophy and archaeology wasn't in a philosophy classroom. It was when I took a summer job on an archaeological field crew that the National Historic Sites Division of Parks Canada was dispatching to Fort Walsh, Saskatchewan. And here's Fort Walsh in 1878. This is a Northwest Mounted Police fort established in 1875 in the heart of the Cypress Hills. Cypress Hills are an erosional remnant plateau roughly 20 miles square, overlapping what later became the provincial border between Saskatchewan and Alberta in 1905, and just above Montana, which had been incorporated as a U.S. territory in 1864. So 1864, 3 years before Canadian Confederation, just to get the historic picture in place. Crucially, the Cypress Hills were within comparatively easy striking distance of Fort Benton. the highest navigable point on the Missouri River for steamboats, and well established by the early 1870s as a major center for the transshipment of furs, especially buffalo hides, from the Canadian Northwest Territories to the tanning factories and trading houses of St. Louis. Here's an image of some of these famous wagons that would, you know, end up in wagon trains moving goods back and forth across the Northwest Plains, and two maps that indicate where Fort Walsh was in the context of the Northern Plains. Here's another, a map showing the enormously broad range of goods that flowed into Fort Benton and Fort Walsh in the 1870s and 80s. It was a node in a really international network of trade. The wagon train in the photo is at Fort McLeod, which is northwest of Fort Walsh on what was called at the time the Whoop-Up Trail. It was infamous for whiskey trade. It's stunningly beautiful country, described by the Palliser Expedition in 1859 as a veritable oasis in a tract of arid country, which they'd traveled through that year. This is from the Canadian National Geographic just a few years ago, or a decade ago. Its deeply cut stream beds are home to striking stands of wolf willow and lodgepole pine. It would have been teeming with game in the 19th century, beaver and bear, wolf, fox and lynx, elk and deer, in addition to bison. And its exposed benches offer a panoramic view of the prairie, a perfect vantage point from which to track the movements of the great northern buffalo herds until they were hunted to the point of extinction in the service of the voracious fur trade by 1880. And here's a recent National Historic Park site or historic site promotion. Oh, wait a second. Did I miss this? Yeah, there it is. I don't have the image here. So did I miss the previous one? No, you got that one. And here it is. They like to say places you stay and places that stay with you. The official mandate of the Northwest Mounted Police was to, quote, bring law and order to the Canadian West. The brave police were to staunch what was described by a Parks Canada historian as an invasion of the Canadian prairies by a horde of American whiskey traders who callously peddled their rot-gut product to the local Indians. In the process, the Northwest Mounted Police were to settle the so-called Indian situation on the outer edge of what the newly founded Canadian Federation saw as its western frontier, a crucial step toward opening the region to European settlement. The Northwest Territories Act, passed by the fledgling Canadian government in 1875, made it illegal to, quote, import, sell, trade, or produce intoxicants of any kind except under permit, a system designed to staunch the use of alcohol in the trade for buffalo hides. The reason for locating the fort in the Cypress Hills specifically was an infamous massacre of 1873 in which wolfers and whiskey traders attacked an Assiniboine, or now called Nakota, party camped near a pair of independent trading posts, Solomon and Farwell trading posts. News of this Cypress Hills massacre spread quickly, and as emblematic of the lawlessness of whoop-up country, it drove home the need for the Canadian government to make good its commitment to maintain a peaceful frontier under British law in the Northwest Territories. And more pointedly, I'm quoting again Parks Canada historian, more pointedly to, quote, avoid a repetition of the conflict witnessed between Indians and settlers in the American West, which had already gone pretty far down the road of nasty by that time. So this would have been the early 90s. The brochure on the left, the upper image is Sitting Bull and Sioux at Fort Walsh, and the lower image, one of many portraits of, non-commissioned officers. As the buffalo herds met their demise, destroying the subsistence base and frontier trade economy of the region, and as Native Americans were driven up from their homelands by military action to the south, so here Sitting Bull, Tatanka, Iotanka, and some 5,000 Lakota Sioux decamped to the Cypress Hills after their confrontation with Custer at Little Bighorn. And after that, the main function of the Northwest Mounted Police Force stationed at Fort Walsh was essentially diplomatic. A number of Indian treaties were negotiated at Fort Walsh with tribal communities that had been located in the Canadian territories, and the so-called American Sioux were persuaded to return to U.S. territories. In the meantime, rations were distributed at times to thousands of displaced and starving Native Americans camped in the Cypress Hills around Fort Walsh. And the Northwest Mounted Police did what they could to keep peace between tribal nations. These tribal nations, the Métis, the growing population of ranchers and settlers who were moving into the region from eastern Canada and the US. By 1883, the Canadian Pacific Railway line reached Maple Creek, 30 miles to the north of the Cypress Hills, and the fort and town site that had grown up next to it were abandoned. Those who made a go of it established large-scale ranching operations. This is just above what's now the Visitor Reception Center at Fort Walsh. The fort and the massacre site were initially on the property of the Wood and Anderson Ranch, which was established shortly after the fort was abandoned. It was later owned by the Nuttall family, who were still and are still actively in the ranching business. At the time I worked at Fort Walsh in the 70s, they were experimenting with bison ranching. And here's, you know, serious rodeo country, amateur rodeo country. That's archaeology crew watching the rodeo with one serious cowboy at the top. And I was just really struck. They start him off young, little kid on a horse, right? He's going to be riding the minute he can stay securely on top. The 1942, the RCMP, sort of descendant of the Northwest Mounted Police, purchased what became Fort Walsh National Historic Park from the Nuttall family. They built a rough replica of the fort based on historic photographs and ran a horse breeding and remount station on the site until the late 1960s when it was designated a National Historic Site. So as a remount station, that's where all the horses in the Canadian RCMP musical ride were, well, not all of them, but where they were bred and trained. Here's Fort Walsh today, reconstructed by the RCMP and maintained as a National Historic Site. By the time I first visited the site in 73, the Solomon and Farwell trading posts adjacent to the Cypress Hills Massacre site had also been reconstructed, and the whole complex was open to a modest stream of visitors. And this is a little note card I got when I was working at the fort. It's just this astonishingly domestic interior of one of these trading posts where this massacre had happened. The mandate given to the archaeological crews assigned to Fort Walsh between 73 and 78, was to, quote, uncover the precise configuration of the original fort buildings. The RCMP hadn't quite got it right. And to determine exactly what materials had been used in their construction, and quoting again, this is from a Regina Leader Post story of 1974, to recover as many artifacts as possible. This was what would be called, was called in archaeology at the time, historicalist archaeology of a pretty banal sort, pointedly not aimed at an appraisal of received archival history and popular legend where the fort and the Northwest Mounted Police were concerned, much less at understanding the broader context of the fort. We faced stiff resistance from head office, which was in Ottawa at the time, when we undertook a survey and sampling project on an enormous civilian town site that had grown up next to the fort. And we tried to do some survey and testing in the first year we were working at Fort Walsh. And there was strikingly little interest in documenting any of the Native American or Métis sites that surrounded the fort. In fact, there was a lot to be learned archaeologically that has since, I'm happy to say, gotten uptake from the National Historic Park Service. On the matter of enforcing the Northwest Territories Act, bottles tell the story. I love this little brochure report that they produced about 15 years ago. 32 restorable liquor bottles in the commissioner's privy. Third items listed in the inventory of bottles is, you know, champagne, beer, whiskey. Right? We found an enormous wealth of class-differentiated intoxicant bottles, including a great many high-proof patent medicine bottles squirreled away in the footing trenches and under the subfloors of the enlisted men's and officers' barracks. This impression of large-scale consumption of intoxicants by those who were meant to be, you know, holding off the rapacious whiskey traders from the South was reinforced when I later spent a summer digging the latrines associated with those barracks with the commissioner's privy. Latrines are wonderful things archaeologically. And we found even more: beer, liquor, medicine bottles, wine, champagne, you know, the fancy stuff in the commissioner's latrine, not so fancy in the other latrines. Here's a map that integrates everything that's known archaeologically about the civilian town site that appears in a wonderful recent master's thesis by Kim Woods at University of Saskatchewan. And you see here residences, hotels. T.C. Powers and I.G. Baker were two Fort Benton-based trading establishments that controlled the trade into the Northwest Territory. Restaurants, billiard halls, barbershops, stables, lots of unidentified pit features of various kinds, no churches. Apparently, preacher would occasionally appear and, you know, do whatever was necessary in other spaces. As cursory as our work was on the town site, we turned up fascinating evidence of substantial houses and business establishments, in several cases with assemblages. In the case of houses, assemblages indicative of family households, children's toys, shards of patterned china, fragments of a carafe, flatware, a coffee mill, window pane glass, ceramic doorknobs, a lock and key, painted buttons and amber beads, a perfume bottle stopper, bits of musical instruments, and a book binding. A much different picture of life at a key transit point on the infamous Whoop-Up Trail than we'd expected. And finally, the park survey. This is the project that I ran. In my second year in graduate school, I proposed an archaeological survey of the park as a whole, which I directed in 1978, at a point when we'd pretty much finished excavation of the fort. One striking take-home from that project was the sheer density of lithic scatters and clusters of teepee rings and cairns that we found concentrated along the edges of every exposed bench terrace and at the head of every coulee that's sited onto the fort. So the top of the benches are not great campsites in the general scheme of things, but we noted these sites were located exactly where displaced Native Americans could keep a close eye on the Northwest Mounted Police. And every point where there was a sight line onto the fort, we found these kinds of evidence of encampment. We also documented half a dozen clusters of pit features along historic trails that were likely the remains of Métis settlements, some of them no doubt predating the fort by several decades, as well as contemporary with it. Finally, we reported some tantalizing evidence of a much deeper Native American history in the Cypress Hills. One example is an anomalous set of double teepee rings, rather than the single teepee rings we found around looking onto the fort, located on a protected hillside well away from the fort and in a tight circular formation that fit accounts of prehistoric and protohistoric wintering sites in the Cypress Hills. Sadly, by the time I was building this inventory of archaeological resources for the park, a visitor reception center had been constructed right in the middle of one of the densest Native American encampment sites above the fort, and several historic period trails and Métis campsites had been transected by utility roads. So there was a lot of destruction that had happened already in part for the lack of having had any inventory of what was actually on the park property. There has, thankfully, been a significant shift away from this inattention to anything but a selective history of the Northwest Mounted Police in recent years. A 2013 National Historic Park site report puts Native American and Métis history at the center of the management plan for Fort Walsh and emphasizes a commitment to, quote, work cooperatively with representatives from Carry the Kettle First Nation. That's the overarching First Nation who are descendants of those of the smaller group, the Lakota group that suffered the massacre in 1873. So back to the philosophical, you'll be relieved to know, back to philosophy, back to the philosophical storyline. As I quickly learned in the first summer I worked at Fort Walsh, 73, North American anthropological archaeology was in the throes of a revolution, just as Miriam described. So designated by the advocates of the new archaeology, also known as processual archaeologists. And here, thanks to the good people of the Midlands Archaeology Unit in the UK, is a little cartoon of that divide, the processual new archaeologists. Resolutely self-identified as pro-science positivists, new archaeologists insisted that archaeology must move beyond merely collecting and systematizing archaeological data. and indeed must move beyond reconstructing particular events and conditions of the lives and activities that had produced those data. The goal must be to explain these particulars in terms of long-term, large-scale cultural processes. As described in a 1968 review of the earliest of these programmatic statements, the so-called process theorist, this is from Kent Flannery, 1967, the process theorist is not ultimately concerned with the Indian behind the artifact, but with the system behind both the Indian and the artifact. Vintage 67 statement. The hallmark of the new archaeology was insistence that these ambitious goals would require archaeologists to make a sharp break with the inductive speculative modes of practice they attributed, I would say somewhat unfairly, to so-called traditional archaeology. So rather than first gathering the primary archaeological data, documenting the archaeological record, and then generating a just-so story about what it might mean after the fact, new archaeologists insisted that reconstructive explanatory hypotheses should be the starting point for inquiry. They advocated a rigorously problem-oriented hypothesis-testing mode of practice in service, ultimately, of establishing and applying laws of cultural process to archaeologically documented cultural particulars. And they insisted that to realize these epistemic ideals, there was an ontological component to this, theoretical component, archaeologists must abandon the quixotic quest for humanistic understanding of the cultural life world of past cultures. They should embrace an eco-materialist conception of culture, sometimes described again in vintage 60s language as man's extra-somatic means of adaptation, and focus on tracking system-level dynamics, in particular human-environment interactions. In fleshing out these recommendations, the new archaeologists drew heavily on received view, logical positivist, logical empiricist philosophy of science, specifically Hempel's account of covering law models of explanation to define the goals of inquiry, and his hypothetical-deductive account of confirmation to inform the problem-oriented testing practice they endorsed. And ironically, because their aim was to foment revolution, they invoked Kuhn. Instituting positivist-inspired modes of inquiry was going to require a revolutionary break with the entrenched paradigmatic thinking of traditional archaeology. I learned about this intellectual ferment when I was sent a list of readings to slog through in preparation for the 1973 Fort Walsh field season. And on the left is our items that were on that list, with one or two on the other, but the archaeological list, it was a who's who of the new archaeology that was active at the time. The reading list, I didn't include this piece, but it included not only Fort Walsh history and regional archaeology, but these classic statements of the processualist agenda. Lou Binford, the dominant advocate of the new archaeology. Some sources of new archaeology inspiration in historical archaeology, that would be Dietz and Detlefsen. The Flannery Review I cited a moment ago. And some explicitly philosophical work on the nature of explanation by Fritz and Plog and by Watson, LeBlanc, and Redmond. Also, a few of the philosophers and historians of science who were their inspiration on the other column, Hempel and Kuhn. The director of this project, Jim Cesenti, there he is in all his glory, working on the town site the first year we were there. He was an ardent new archaeologist who had been trained at the University of Arizona, at the time a stronghold of the new archaeology. He strained mightily against the constraints of a national park bureaucracy. Here's how I described his approach to archaeology in the preface to Thinking from Things in 2002. What made archaeology worth doing, in Cesenti's view, was not just the intrinsic interest of the enterprise, the wholly absorbing process of recovering tangible evidence of past human aspirations and accomplishments, but what it could teach us about the conditions of life, the reasons for cultural change and persistence, affinity and diversity that manifested themselves in the gritty particulars of the archaeological record. For him, as for many others at the time, archaeology was anthropology or it was nothing. It shouldn't be done, actually, was the argument. Cesenti insisted that one should never put trowel or spade or pick, or as you see in the background here, backhoe to ground without clearly formulating a question and a research strategy for addressing it. We debated not just what questions to ask, but what counts as a research question, and how the fine points of how to implement a testing strategy. We agonized about the enigmatic nature of the archaeological record. Even when you could put a name and a date to the alcohol bottles and patent medicine bottles we were digging up, we were acutely aware that we didn't necessarily understand their significance as evidence. How exactly had they come into the hands of the Northwest Mounted Police? Were they seized contraband that they then consumed, or did they just pour it out into their privies and not consume it? Were some of it legally acquired by permit? I'm guessing what I dug out of the commissioner's privy was largely legal, but the other stuff not so much. If it was legal, why were all of this evidence of alcohol possible consumption dumped in latrines and buried in footing trenches rather than disposed of in more public places like official garbage dumps? Crucially, we wrestled with the implications of finding disconcertingly often that an unforgiving and unobliging archaeological record could be counted on not to conform to our best hypotheses, even maybe especially those based on seemingly incontrovertible documentary history. We also wrestled with ethical and political issues. It was frustration with the Euro and military centrism of the National Historic Sites Archaeological Program that motivated me to propose a walkover survey of the park property as a whole. And it was the experience of listening to running debate about what we should do with human remains, if we found any, that brought home to me the ways in which we were all complicit in continuing the legacy of displacement, appropriation, and denial enacted in the form of colonial diplomacy at Fort Walsh in the 1870s and 80s. Then current wisdom was that you should hope that any human remains that turn up, that any human remains will turn up with clear evidence of Native American identity, in which case you could disinter and send to headquarters as a find. Otherwise, you would be tied up in what our Native American colleagues described as interminable white tape, negotiating with the county coroner and chasing down possible descendants, or attempting to demonstrate that there were none. The difference was stark. And even though this is like a decade and a half, two decades before Native American Grave Protection Repatriation Act and those highly public debates about repatriation, it was just clear how profoundly unjust those practices, those norms were. When I returned to Mount A in my sophomore year, I took Paul Bogard's Introduction to History and Philosophy of Science. Back in the day, those were year-long courses. We read Hempel and Kuhn again. This is now the other side of the panel. This time in the company of Hansen, Popper, Scheffler, and Hull, among others, who were breaking with the orthodoxy of received view, logical positivism, empiricism. Bogard encouraged us to write term papers on philosophical issues arising in actual research practice. So I wrote on the question, was archaeology undergoing a Kuhnian revolution? The answer was, it depends on what you consider a revolution to be and whether you think the assumptions and practices of traditional archaeology constituted a paradigm. In the process, I discovered that several philosophers of science, a number of them, were already actively engaged in debating the philosophical issues raised by the new archaeologists. A few were scathing critics of what they saw as ill-conceived and uninformed appropriations of philosophical terms of art. Chuck Morgan at the University of Victoria, for example, wrote a trashing review of Watson, LeBlanc, and Redmond's explanation in archaeology, decrying their failure to grasp the niceties of philosophical debate about covering law models. While he was certainly right about many of the specifics of this failed attempt at what he called cross-field trade, I had considerable sympathy for Watson, LeBlanc, and Redmond when they objected that, for his part, Morgan had not bothered to learn enough about the problems that had led them to the philosophical literature to be any constructive help in addressing them. I took this exchange to be an instructive negative object lesson in how to alienate potential partners, practitioners, and shut philosophy off in its own little possible world. By contrast, a number of others rolled up their sleeves and went to work in ways that illustrated what might be learned by all parties if trading relations were predicated on a serious effort to understand what one another's terms of art mean in context and what the stakes are in using them, what questions or problems they were designed to address. So here are some of these field-crossing mentors. I'll come back to the amphibian bit later. Chief among them was Merrily Salmon, who had already published, you saw on some of those earlier reading list, she published several short articles in archaeology contexts in the 70s doing exactly this, disambiguating key philosophical terms. And in 1982, she published this marvelous book, Philosophy and Archaeology, the culmination of or catalyzed by a series of exchanges with a tight-knit group of new archaeologists at the University of Arizona who were experimenting with processual approaches in the US Southwest, the very ones who had trained my field director, Jim Cesenti. Later, as a postdoc, I worked with with Marcia Hannon and Jane Kelly. That's Marcia at the top on the, what is that? You're right. And Jane Kelly, hard at work on a site in Chihuahua, Mexico, an archaeologist. They were both at Calgary, where I was a postdoc. Marcia, a Goodman-trained philosopher of science and law, Jane, a Mesoamericanist, published together a book called Archaeology and the Methodology of Science in 1982, a sustained argument for understanding archaeological theorizing as a form of inference to the best explanation. It's still well worth a read, especially as IBE, you know, resurfaces as a matter of interest. And then on the bottom left is Patty Jo Watson and Red Watson, who are at Washington University. Patty Jo was the lead author of that book, Explanation in Archaeology, that Morgan reviewed so unsympathetically. She is famous for her work on the origins of agriculture in the Near East, in Turkey, and also in Eastern North America, but she had serious philosophical interests. And Red, her husband, was a Descartes scholar who also wrote extensively on philosophical issues in archaeology. I think he was imprinted by Rudner at Washington. That was the point of connection. As I came to the end of my undergraduate training, I searched out graduate programs where I could work at this interface between philosophy of science and archaeology. And I had the good fortune to enter the program in History and Philosophy of the Social Behavioral Sciences that Ted Michel established at SUNY Binghamton in 1975. This program required at least an MA level of training in a social science. And as a one-of-a-kind experiment, it attracted an extraordinary range of visiting faculty. Hamlin and Gibson, who worked with the folks who were doing stuff on philosophy of psychology, Dick Boyd from Cornell, Ram Haray from Oxford, who later supervised my dissertation. And here they are. Tragically, Ted Michel died in December 1976, my first semester at Binghamton, and the program soon lost its funding. But I got support to complete my degree at Binghamton, and the department generously allowed me to spend two semesters out of residence, one at the University of Arizona, taking courses with Merrily and Wes Salmon, and a second in the UK at Oxford, doing tutorials with Ram Haray. When in Binghamton, I also worked with several other philosophy faculty, in particular Leon Goldstein. I couldn't find a photo of him, but that book of his on historical knowing is now gaining some attention that I think it's deserved for a long time. It's a cluster of articles now out discussing this approach. And it's very much a practice-oriented approach to understanding historical inquiry. I also worked with a cluster of energetic second-generation new archaeologists, two of whom joined my dissertation committee, Chuck Redman, Southwestern Archaeology, and Meg Conkey, a foremost figure establishing feminist research program in archaeology, who worked on Paleolithic Spanish cave art and mobiliary art. In a dissertation on positivism and the new archaeology, I explored what I saw as a fundamental disconnect between the positivist rhetoric of the new archaeology and what I characterized as essentially realist ambitions. Their oft-stated goal was to move beyond description of the observables of the archaeological record. It was definitely not to save the phenomena. I argued that in practice, their strategies of inquiry were better understood as a sophisticated form of model building, no laws in sight, or at least none that met the description of high-level laws of cultural process, and none that did the explanatory work they insisted must be the goal of the enterprise. By the time I defended my dissertation in 1981, this internal fault line, as I referred to it, was clearly evident. Sympathetic internal critics, that is, sympathetic to the new archaeology, had raised virtually all the central points of objection that brought down received view, logical positivism, empiricism in philosophical contexts. In particular, they recognized that the deductivism of their HD-inspired testing program was untenable, citing what amounted to concerns about underdetermination and the theory lateness of archaeological data as evidence. By the early 80s, a much more sharply adversarial critique was taking shape, led by a philosophically savvy young cohort of archaeologists at Cambridge in the UK, who I'd met when I was over there studying with Hooray, advocates of the anti-positivist post-processualism. That was the crowd with the slouching trousers in that cartoon a little while back. Drawing on post-Kuhn contextualist philosophy of science and strong program science studies of the day, as well as a range of continental sources, they pushed to the limit the implications of an uncompromising anti-foundationalism. The data that comprise the archaeological record are meaningless in themselves. They can't even be identified as archaeological. They require without substantial interpretive scaffolding. And the scaffolding means that to stand as evidence, vicious circularity, in their view, was inescapable. Archaeologists should just candidly acknowledge that they simply project a presentist image of the past onto enigmatic archaeological data. They should just tell the stories that need to be told. These then are the theory wars I mentioned at the outset, a sharply oppositional debate that ran hot through the 90s and has since gone underground. As one commentator describes it, 2010, the angry claims and counterclaims about relativism and its dangers have largely subsided, but not because the underlying issues have been resolved. What's taken hold, says Matthew Johnson, is an unreflective live and let live pluralism that exempts a great many untenable assumptions from reasoned examination. I note that this dynamic of debate is by no means unique to archaeology or to the science wars era of the 90s. Although I was sympathetic to these critiques of narrow empiricism, I have been intent on showing that these dire consequences do not follow from the constructionism and contextualism invoked by post-processual critics. When evidential reasoning in practice is examined at a lower altitude than generic theses of theory-ladenness, underdetermination, and holism, it's clear that however heavily selected and interpreted archaeological data are as evidence, they do have, as I learned in the field, considerable capacity to, quote, resist theoretical appropriation, a term sometimes used or phrased by post-processualists, ironically. This is a capacity that arises, I argue, from a range of constraints, conceptual and empirical, that are all too often obscured by the simplifying abstractions of philosophical models. The philosophical challenge, as I see it, is to tease out the operating norms and strategies of evidential reasoning that are rarely made explicit except under duress and articulate their epistemic rationale. Here's a sketch of the model of evidential reasoning I've developed over the years, published last fall in a book I co-authored with an archaeological colleague in the UK, Bob Chapman. First of all, most of the inferential action is offstage. The key to building evidential claims is to establish a robust body of background knowledge. Much of the ladening theory on which archaeologists rely is better understood not as arbitrary interpretive conventions of the kind vilified by ardent post-processualists, but material postulates in John Norton's sense. Substantive background knowledge that functions as warrants in a toolman-like schema, what I've come to think of as a toolman-like schema of practical reasoning. Here's a simple version of the toolman schema, I'm sure familiar to many of you. If you think of evidential reasoning in archaeology as a form of practical argument, it's clear that practitioners must recruit or assume a great many different kinds of warrants and backing to traverse the inferential gap between data and evidential claims. And many of these are themselves open to systematic adjudication on evidential grounds. So here's the simplified version, that's the basic toolman schema. Here's a simplified archaeological example, a simplified version of a famous historical case, the Red Lady of Paviland. Human remains discovered in sealed cave deposits in southern Wales in 1823 by William Buckland, a staunch defender of a biblical conception of human activity. So he discovered these important remains and then spent his career trying to established that they, you know, undercut what they are now understood to have established about human antiquity. I'm using rebuttal here in a broader sense than Toulmin does to refer to challenges to any element of this evidential argument, including the integrity of the data cited and the inference-mediating warrants, which together establish the plausibility and determine the scope of the evidential claims they're meant to support. The point is that there are a great many moving parts, but that over the course of a century, rigorous scrutiny of the data and the warrants made possible by pivotal developments in a whole range, diverse range of other fields, provided the empirical and conceptual resources to answer the rebuttals brought to bear by Buckland and his successors. In more conventional terms, the point is that archaeological data are laden by many different kinds of theory in the process of being selected and interpreted as evidence. These lines of evidence can be systematically adjudicated for the degree of security they carry in their own right. They are by no means all and equally insecure, nor are they bound into a hypercoherent web of belief of the kind that might warrant a suspicion that the evidence you construct will necessarily conform to expectation. In short, pernicious circularity is not inevitable or pervasive. I argue more specifically that these conditions and practices put archaeologists in a position to exploit epistemic independence on two dimensions. Vertical independence, this is bootstrapping in a generic sense, where the warrants you rely on to establish evidential claims are not constituents of the hypotheses or theories you use these claims to support or assess. So the claims about human antiquity that the evidence from Paviland ultimately supported don't presuppose or entail the geological principles of superposition that establish the association of the human remains with extinct mammoth remains. Horizontal independence is the capacity of multiple lines of evidence to constrain one another when mediated by warrants derived from quite different causal systems that concern quite different causal systems and are backed by conceptually and methodologically distinct research programs. So again, the geological principles that establish contemporaneity are causally and conceptually independent from the faunal analysis required to establish an identification of the animal bones as extinct mammoth rather than misplaced Roman elephant bones. This is robustness reasoning of a workaday variety. Evidential reasoning in archaeology exemplifies what Hasek Chang describes as strategies of epistemic iteration by which we, quote, to quote Hasek, we build scientific knowledge in the absence of infallible foundations. In this spirit, I urge that we think of evidential claims as stabilized by dense tangles of empirical conceptual argument that are mutually reinforcing and mutually constraining. This is an image that Nancy Cartwright uses and John Norton uses in various places that I find really fruitful. What we need philosophically then is an account or a family of purpose-specific accounts that allow us to distinguish in a principled way between vicious and virtuous tangles. Here on the far side is the evidential reasoning book that Bob Chapman and I wrote together, and on the other side with the beautiful Welsh rock petroglyph is a collection of essays that we co-edited. With this account, while this account of evidence is deeply informed by my field experience at Fort Walsh and on half a dozen other archaeological projects I've been involved in since, it's through a different kind of engagement with archaeology that my practice leanings have taken a more richly social contextualist turn. In the late 80s, I participated in a workshop and then a public conference that were pivotal in establishing what's now a thriving program of gender research in archaeology. And Meg Conkey, who I mentioned earlier, was a co-editor of the Engendering Archaeology book on the far side. At the time, I was also involved in feminist activism, working on the Chile climate initiatives at the University of Western Ontario, and I was collaborating with Kathleen O'Krulik on a SHRC-funded project cataloging the diverse array of feminist critiques of science that were appearing across the social and life sciences, as well as in the cognate fields of HPS and STS. A few years later, I was enlisted by the executive board of the Society for American Archaeology to co-convene a task force that ultimately drafted the principles of archaeological ethics. This is just the first kind of framing principle of nine. They were adopted in 1996. It was in this connection that I learned firsthand about the work of a growing constituency of archaeologists whose response to the demands for repatriation, marked in the U.S. by the passage of NAGPRA in 1990, had been to build collaborative partnerships with indigenous descent communities around the world. And here's IPINCH, Intellectual Property Issues and Cultural Heritage. It's a Canadian SHRC-funded project at Simon Fraser University that has supported over 7 years, just finished recently, supported and documented a wide range of such partnerships and projects. In both cases, I was shocked that even as these initiatives gained traction, proving themselves not only viable but highly productive, those advocating them faced profoundly hostile, even vitriolic, critiques from their colleagues. They were charged with professional disregard for the goals and standards of archaeology. They saw their work dismissed as just political, worse, as threatening the integrity and credibility of archaeology as a discipline. I saw some excellent archaeology being done in these contexts, measured by any standards, some of it strikingly innovative. It's borne fruit that no one could have imagined that wasn't, you know, would never have been realized just doing business as usual. Feminist and community-based collaborative practitioners alike focused attention on aspects of mainstream best practice research that had never been questioned or explored. They challenged problematic framework assumptions, norms of justification that had marginalized key lines of evidence, lines of inquiry that had never been taken up. And in both cases, it struck me that what made it possible to disembed these taken for granted, to hold them accountable and think outside the box, was precisely the situated, in some cases explicitly political angle of vision that gender researchers brought to bear as women and feminists, and that Indigenous partners brought to bear as critically engaged stakeholders. Thinking as a philosopher, this was another case in which the dynamics of actual practice raised pointed questions that mainstream philosophical models of science have been ill-equipped to answer. How were these contributions realized in what seemed direct contravention of philosophical wisdom and methodological convention that properly scientific inquiry, systematic empirical inquiry, must be value-free, must be rigorously insulated against the influence of situated interests? Most poignant in these cases is the role played by these very philosophical models. I'm going to say, like, they're in many respects outmoded, but still influential philosophical models as a source of legitimation for those intent on excluding and trivializing the insights of dissident insider outsiders. In the last decade, I've been intent on articulating an account of feminist standpoint theory that meets the objections of critics who see it as epistemic identity politics gone wrong. This is a matter of formulating decidedly non-ideal epistemic norms, elements of a multidimensional account of situated objectivity that have the resources not only to make sense of feminist and critical race research practice, but also potentially to inform it. So to conclude, in answer to the questions with which I opened, I would argue that archaeology and indeed any serious program of empirical inquiry is always already deeply philosophical. Practitioners grapple with epistemic and ethical issues, normative issues in their everyday practice. And the way they navigate these issues in practice suggests a very different scientific image than that which has until recently informed mainstream philosophy of science. Applying feminist standpoint theory reflexively to our own practice, I suggest that philosophy is very much enriched by ongoing intentional engagement with practitioners. We often do our best work when we operate in a trading zone, expanding our horizons rather than policing ever narrowing boundaries around the truly pure philosophical. Beyond naturalizing impulses, this requires amphibious training and practice of a kind described in the late 70s by Mario Bungay, who I never met, but it turns out he was a colleague of Bruce Trigger's, and they were fond colleagues and sparring partners their whole careers at McGill. Now, this is a vision of philosophy of science that I found enormously inspiring when I came upon it as a graduate student. I wasn't surprised to learn, as I've just said, years later, that it made an impression on Bruce Trigger as well. So there's another philosophy archaeology partnership. Thank you.